manager say that the videotape from the dossier, the Steele dossier, was actually authentic. I mean, it was just, it would be the biggest story ever, but it was so obviously fabricated. And the confusion came because the date and time on the document that Rachel got was a few hours before we published. So that made her think whoever got this document got it before we published. And the confusion was that the date and time on the document is not the date and time that we published it, but the date and time that we uploaded it to the internet, which matched perfectly the date and time on the document that we published. So it was clear that the person who sent it to her didn't get it before we published and didn't have special access, but got it when we put it on online. That was the primary point of that article.
And Glenn, very quickly before we conclude, Betsy Reid says, and you said as well, that an internal review has been conducted at The Intercept to see how the identity of the alleged leaker was revealed. So what did the internal review show about what mistakes The Intercept made?
I mean, I wish more than anything we could take that internal review and put it online. The problem is that lawyers, our lawyers and others, have warned that if we disclose information about the internal processes of our reporting, there's a risk that the government could use some of that information or try to use it to bolster their prosecution of Reality Winner. And the last thing we want to do or should do is say anything or do anything that further jeopardizes this person who, if the accusations against her are correct, was simply acting as a person of conscience, trying to disclose to the public information that she felt was newsworthy, and that was newsworthy. So we're not going to do that.
Glenn Greenwald, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, founder, co-founder of The Intercept. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 5 o'clock. The evening news is next.
KBOO.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag Fuzzy Boo, and you'll be entered to win a chance to have Fuzzy Boo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/fuzzyboo.
KBOO Community Radio and the Jazz Society of Oregon are proud to present the 37th Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, July 14th, 15th, and 16th at Cathedral Park in North Portland. The event starts with blues on Friday night. Andy Stokes, Julie Amici, and the Rose City Kings will be there. Saturday and Sunday, we'll have Uriel Thomas and the Pain, Manuel Valera, Ezra Weiss Big Band, the Midnight Serenaders, Shirley Nanette, and more. Again, that's the 37th Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, the longest-running community event in Portland, July 14th, 15th, and 16th, under the St. John's Bridge in North Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as KBOO Night every second Thursday. Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast 26th and Clinton in Portland. Schedule an info at 503-238-5588 or ctspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, new draft directives from the Portland Police Bureau could replace the old 48-hour rule with something potentially worse.
We'll have a live interview with Los Angeles-based artist Rakeem Cunningham.
And we'll take an in-depth look at the fight against Oregon State University's plan to demolish a community center used by a variety of international student groups.
Good Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 13th, 2017. I'm Zelos.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. The Halprin sequence was created by landscape architect Lawrence Halprin, who in the 1960s had unique ideas about how people and parks could interact. The sequence is a series of architecturally open designs for parks with fountains. Each park was made with the intention of it being a living room for their communities. This approach gave life to parts of a city. One of Portland's most well-known Halprin sequences was built in 1966 and 1970 as a vital part of the South Auditorium Urban Renewal District. Under a Federal Housing Act, money was given to cities across the country to improve so-called blighted areas. In 1955, a Portland City Council committee began its work recommending a clearance of 6 blighted areas inside Portland city limits. One area was the South Auditorium District that held a large African American neighborhood. 110 acres were declared decrepit, and today between Southwest Clay Street and Market Street, across from the Keller Auditorium, is the nation's largest Halprin sequence. Among shady trees in the spring and summer, its towering incongruent plateaus sport impressive waterfalls that dive into waist-deep pools, offering an easy way to cool off. These days, many of Halprin's sequences have fallen into disrepair, and the Portland Open Space sequence is hosting an event to save them. Finding the Way to the Halprin sequence is a wayfinding campaign that takes place this Saturday in partnership with Portland Parks and Recreation's 50th celebration. The event starts at 10:30 a.m. at the Portland State University Recreational Center. Interested volunteers are being asked to post signs that lead to Portland's Halprin Fountain, ending with a celebration nearby. To find out more, organizers are asking people to visit their Facebook page, www.facebook.com/findyourwayhalprin.
The Portland Police Bureau released new drafts of key directives on July 1st. The directives under review are 10-10 use of force and 10-10.10, which deals with deadly force and custody deaths and reporting procedures. The most glaring change was made to the second directive. Under the use of force policy and the new draft version of it, officers who use certain kinds of force against citizens are required to write a report the same day. The PPB's general offense reports contain a section called the Force Data Collection Report, in which the officer is to give a narrative description of the incident. Under the new draft, officers involved in the death of a civilian in the line of duty will not have to write a report until after the end of the criminal investigation. Officers who use deadly force that does not end in death, the reporting will be left to the supervisor. To reiterate, if an officer discharges a beanbag round that misses its target, they have to write a force report that day. If the same officer fires live ammunition and hits somebody without killing them, they themselves are exempt from writing a force report at all. This rule supplants the infamous, quote, 48-hour, end quote, rule, which was scrapped during negotiations with the police union last year and required a period of 48 hours after an officer-involved death before anybody could interview the officer.
The proposed changes have raised the ire of citizen watchdogs for several reasons. For one thing, the period of the 4 public reviews ends tomorrow, July 14th, giving the public a total of 2 weeks to comment on 8 proposed directives. The new drafts also come with no outline or markings to indicate what was changed. A coalition of community groups wrote to the Chief Marshman a week ago to ask for more time to review the new policies. Marshman responded by email on Monday saying that extending the comment period or requiring the directives to be heard before City Council would, quote, cause us to miss the fall in-service training cycle, end quote. He went on to say that missing that period of training would cause the Bureau to miss deadlines agreed upon by the city and the Department of Justice. Dan Handelman of the Portland Cop Watch pointed out in a public comment today that one of the key promises of the DOJ settlement, that deadly force be treated the same as any other type of force, quote, appears to have gone out the window, end quote. He and others in the coalition allege that the rushed timeline and large number of directives up for review act as a kind of Trojan horse for controversial new use of force policies. The draft directives can be read at the Bureau's website by clicking on Directives and going to the section for Review and Develop.
20-year-old Christian Gutierrez was charged as an adult in the 2015 massacre of an entire Laysan albatross colony on the island of Oahu. He was given 45 days in prison, charged with felony theft and animal cruelty, and given a year of probation. The attack on the colony was led by a group of boys from Panahu School, a prestigious academy in the same school that former President Barack Obama attended. They were given special privy to the island and the colony as a part of a school camping trip. Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Giannis Futa said these killings, quote, smacked of privilege and entitlement, end quote. The boys decapitated the birds, stomped on their eggs, and cut off their feet to obtain their tag information as trophies and shared pictures of the event on social media. Conservationists are claiming that the damage has taken their efforts back by 10 years and caused over $200,000 in damages. The Laysan albatross has a wingspan of up to 7 feet and can fly up to 2,000 miles in a single stretch. These particular birds and their nesting colonies are particularly vulnerable to the rising sea levels. This colony in particular was seen as a great success because it provided an alternate nesting site to their disappearing habitat.
Former President and avid humanitarian Jimmy Carter collapsed in Winnipeg while building for Habitat for Humanity. The 92-year-old had been hard at work building houses for the needy when he announced that he was tired. Moments later, he was given a chair before collapsing. He was rushed to a nearby hospital and was treated for dehydration. Currently, he is out of the hospital but under observation as a precaution. The former president and first lady have been in Edmonton, Canada, participating in the 34th annual Jimmy and Rosalind Carter Work Project, in which they were building 75 houses for the local community. Carter released a statement that said he was okay and encourages everyone to stay hydrated and keep building.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production.
For WIN, I'm Joanne Powers. 1,000 airport workers in Philadelphia and the New York City area have suspended a strike after walking off the job at 9 p.m. Tuesday night. The workers are employed by Prime Flight, a subcontractor of American Airlines. Both companies reached out last night to return to the bargaining table. Service Employees International Union 32BJ Vice President Shirley Aldabal says that at JFK, Prime Flight refused to bargain in good faith, despite being ordered to by a district court.
When they came back to the table, they illegally threatened workers for participating in bargaining. We've been trying to get an election at LaGuardia Airport. They have basically openly said that even if the workers prevail, they have no intention of bargaining with us. They continue to engage in anti-union illegal tactics to intimidate and bully the workers. The workers have basically had enough. If Prime Flight continues to refuse to bargain with the union, we're going to be back out there, resume the strike.
The workers are negotiating over issues including job security, respect for seniority, and health and safety concerns.
It's basically dignity and respect on the job that you only get when you have a union and you have a contract.
After months of talks, 200 low-wage cleaners represented by the same union have also voted to authorize a strike at the Reagan National Airport in Washington, D.C., after their employer refused to provide affordable health care and an income that keeps up with the airport's living wage. The Washington workers are subcontracted by the airport authority directly, SEIU 32BJ spokesperson Julie Carrant.
In an attempt to save money back in the 80s under Reagan, they went to a subcontracting system. One of their cost-cutting measures is by lowering wages and benefits for these workers. And whether or not it's the airlines that hire these contractors or the airport authority directly, these contractors are all lowering standards for these workers. These are workers doing backbreaking work to keep the airports clean, and it's not much to ask to have affordable health care and livable wages.
Over 1,200 nurses at Tufts Medical Center in Boston began a 24-hour strike on Wednesday, the city's first nurses' strike in over 30 years. Negotiations between the union and the hospital broke down over long-term staffing inadequacies. Mary Havlicek Kornakia is co-chair of the bargaining unit for the Massachusetts Nurses Association.
We had hoped to never have to actually utilize taking a strike. We had such a large number of votes for the strike and such overwhelming turnout for the last best and final no vote. We had hoped the hospital would see that as an indication that we weren't going to take it lying down, that we really meant what we're fighting for here, that the hospital wasn't listening to what we were trying to tell them. We're going to make every effort to return to work tomorrow morning at 7 a.m., but we have been told that the hospital intends to lock us out for 4 additional days.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
It's 5:13, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Wall Street analysts tell us that Amazon's $14 billion buyout of Whole Foods Market is not only a win-win for them, but also for consumers. Why? Because Amazon intends to lower the organic grocer's prices. Really? Yes, say the analysts, because Amazon will use its amazing computer-driven tactics to cut Whole Foods' cost of selling groceries. But Amazon's robotic efficiency is achieved by cutting people. It squeezes suppliers, for example, demanding that they give bankrupt-level wholesale prices to the retail colossus. That means small organic farmers and food artisans are destined to be squeezed out of Whole Foods, displaced by deep-pocket global food makers who are willing to cut corners on quality and the environment in order to get on Amazon's new grocery shelves. Next will come Whole Foods' helpful and friendly workforce. Jeff Bezos, Amazon CEO, doesn't view workers as assets but as costs. So to jack up the grocery chain's profit, he'll cut those costs, aka people. He's already testing a store concept that has no cashiers to interfere with your shopping experience, using computer sensors to take your money electronically instead of paying bothersome humans to do the job of checking you out and, God forbid, conversing with you. Oh, another plus of connecting us to the corporate computers is that they will track and record our every move and every purchase, building a detailed personal profile on each of us in order to, well, to do what and why. This is Jim Hightower saying, according to the calendar, we're living in 2017, but the brave new future of Amazon's electronic robotic Whole Foods Market tells us we're living in the corporatized version of 1984. It's a world in which the human need for jobs and personal relationships are subverted to the corporate love of automation and avaricious profits.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Iraqi government is currently investigating a video of Iraqi soldiers throwing an unarmed man off a cliff and then shooting his body midair. Now that the battle for Mosul is officially over, it does not mean the end to violence is in the near future, as there have been many reports of extrajudicial killings, beatings, rapes, and other serious crimes committed by Iraqi forces in the area during the war, and there are still thought to be a couple hundred more fighters within the city. The Interior Ministry spokesperson said that if these videos are indeed authentic, the perpetrators would most certainly have to be brought to justice. Human Rights Watch has been keeping an eye on the area and recently published four different eyewitness accounts of beating and killing unarmed men. Senior Iraq researcher at Human Rights Watch, Balikas Willi, told the BBC, quote, "In the final weeks of the battle for West Mosul, the pervasive attitude that I have observed among armed forces has been of momentum, the desire to get the battle wrapped up as quickly as possible, and the collapse of adherence to the laws of war," end quote. These actions could also help exacerbate the anger over abuses of the Sunni Muslims by the security forces that many felt led to the jihadi movement in the first place, development of ISIS. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on a group that is protesting the Oregon State University's decision to demolish a community center in Corvallis. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will have a low of 51 with clear skies, while tomorrow will have a high of 87 and a low of 54. Today in history, in 587 BC, a Babylonian army under Nebuchadnezzar ended its siege of Jerusalem, which included the destruction of the first temple. This was the beginning of the Babylonian exile period of Jewish history, as many from the city were taken as captives to Babylon, present-day southern Iraq. Also in 1985, Vice President George H.W. Bush became acting president for a day when Ronald Reagan underwent surgery to remove polyps from his colon. The quote of the day is from The Master and Margarita by the Russian dissident writer Mikhail Bulgakov, saying, quote, Whoever told you there is no such thing in the world as real, true, everlasting love? May the liar have his despicable tongue cut out. End quote. Matthew Robert Fink, better known by his stage name, Dr. Fink, is an American keyboardist, record producer, and songwriter. He is more famously known as a member of the rock group The Revolution, the backup band for pop musician Prince. Fink won a Grammy Award in 1985 for the album Purple Rain, which sold over 18 million copies. And he and The Revolution will be playing the Rolson Theater July 14th. KBOO's Jamila Burden and Tim Nakayama sat down with Dr. Fink to talk more about the Revolution's revolution.
I'm interested in the term revolution because that means many things to different people. And you look at bands like Sly and the Family Stone or Betty Davis, I think musically that was revolutionary, where you had people of different genders, ethnicities come together, experiences, and then you have a group of people in Minneapolis, Minnesota, come together with that same range of experiences. And to call it the revolution, what is in your mind when you thought about being in that band, your experiences in that band, and what was revolutionary about it to you?
Well, more importantly, it was meant to be inclusive to everyone of any age group, gender, sexual orientation, and race. And that was Prince's whole philosophy, was to bring the, black, white, Puerto Rican, everybody freaking, from the lyric in the song Uptown from 1981.
Yes.
So early on in his career, he held that belief. Along with the rest of us, we all had that same mentality growing up, too. You know, we were all children of the 60s, and you had the whole civil rights movement going on, the influence of that. You had the influence of different ethnicities working together, beginning to warm up to the idea of working together more and more in our society, and multiracial marriages were taking place, and, the play Care came out, the hippie movement, with all of those philosophies being put out into the social mores of the day. So there was so much change afoot. Social consciousness was changing dramatically in the 60s. So we all had that instilled in us. My parents actually took me to see the play Hair in Chicago. We were there on a special trip with my dad. Had a business trip. He took us all there with him from Minneapolis, and then my parents took us to see Hair. At the age of 10, they didn't seem to mind that there would be nudity on stage for a 10-year-old. So you can kind of see where they were coming from a liberal standpoint in their belief system at the time. So. Which was rare, because most parents from that time frame were not like that. But they were, unless you were part of the hippie movement. I don't think Prince's parents were of that same mentality, but he took on what he absorbed, coming in at him from the media and what was happening in the world at that time. So he kind of kept that going into his adulthood years, and wanting to remain, having people be included in whatever he was doing, all people. So that was the whole importance of it, and what was revolutionary about it. But when you go back to the Beatles, when they were playing live in the early 60s, and of course they were the groundbreaking group that started playing in stadiums because they were so big. But when they went down south and they were playing in places like Birmingham, Alabama, and elsewhere, where there was still segregation, they said, we're not going to play there unless black people are allowed to come in.
Dusty Springfield actually did the same thing when she was in South Africa. Yeah.
Yeah, Dusty Springfield. There were more than one artist that did that. But I think the Beatles were one of the first. So, but they, she followed suit, I'm sure, just because of that's what she believed. So Prince was continuing in that kind of thing. And, you know, and there was still segregation going on in the music industry and in radio at the time. And, you know, in Minneapolis, you had one black R&B pop station, which was called KMOJ. Maybe you've heard of it. Maybe you haven't.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was the go-to place for black artists. And, you know, playing the national black artists and the ones that were local in the Twin Cities. So, you know, and so when Prince in the early years would, you know, try to get onto national TV shows or talk shows, he really wasn't there yet. And then he broke through on MTV, of course, like Michael Jackson did ahead of him. So Michael kind of broke down the walls a bit. And then Prince came in and also did the same thing. It was, I'd say those were the two top artists of that time frame that, you know, were able to break through into a big mass audience that were of, you know, would be classified as black music. You know, because sort of like you had the Grammys and you had the American Music Awards, they all had these categories. You were categorized. You were put into black music and rock music and all that stuff, which was kind of unfortunate, you know, and also for the segregation that still was taking place back then, even in the music industry and in how, you know, radio stations operated.
I remember David Bowie kind of holding Mark Goodman to the task on MTV about the lack of a black artist except for Prince and Michael Jackson. That always stuck out for me.
Yeah, I saw that interview too. After David passed away, they dug that out of the archives and put that out there to show that he was a true champion of civil rights, you know, and equality amongst races in this country. So, and in Europe, you know, they're more, to me, you know, the Europeans have been more progressive. They've been ahead of the curve compared to the United States when it comes to inclusiveness. So they find it, looking at our society, they can't understand why we weren't more equal and open about those things in the 60s. Because they were already over the curve with that. They were pretty much beyond that, which is why black artists could go over to Europe and have a great time and go over big, because they were so widely accepted. And then, you know, this kind of thing with our current healthcare system, it kind of carries over into the European societies believing that healthcare is a right, as opposed to the United States, the only industrialized nation in the world, pretty much, that has not taken on a single-payer system with the belief that it's a right and not a privilege.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
We haven't gotten over that hump yet here, and we need to make that transition, I believe.
Can we go back in time to when you first met Prince, what that was like, and where that happened, and how that went down, and how you got involved with the Revolution and playing with him? You were talking about how he heard you jamming, so that's why he invited you to the band. But like your very first encounter with him, what was that like? And if you can recall,
it was actually for the audition to be in the group. It was the first time I met him, and I had managed to get an audition through Bobby Z, the original drummer, who had been working with Prince's original manager, Owen Husney, at the time. And then Bobby was brought in to be the drummer, even though he had been an assistant to Owen, and really in the beginning was only just being brought in to help Prince, you know, kind of run him around and show him the ropes. And just, you know, Bobby's a little bit older than Prince, so Bobby was telling Prince, well, you know, if you're interested, I'd like to also, you know, try to be your drummer. And Prince said, I don't know, not so sure about that. But in the end, he brought Bobby on board to be the drummer. So by the time I got the audition to be in the band, the whole band had been put together except for the last keyboard player slot. And then I was, through knowing Bobby and calling him and calling the manager and saying, hey, I'm really wanting to do this, because Bobby, we knew each other, and he had played me Prince's demo about a year before. And I just said, wow, this is a great band. Who is it? And he goes, it's not a band. It's a kid like you, same age. And he did everything in the studio. And I said, wow, that's unheard of, not to mention amazing. And so I just said, well, what's he doing with this? What are you going to do? And they go, well, we're going to shop it to major labels and hopefully get him a record deal. And from there, make an album and or two and see what happens. And I said, great, once you're putting a band together. That's when I offered my services as his keyboard player.
Rakim Cunningham is an LA-based black multimedia artist who is visiting Portland with a special exhibition titled White Artists Don't Have to Make Art About Racial Identity. It's a mixed media piece hosted by Litman White at the White Gallery in Portland, Oregon. Rakim favors fantastical uses of textures that include fabric, animated seamless paper, and free-flowing plastic wrap. In 2013, Cunningham came out as a gay man, which opened up a whole new world with it newfound levels of oppression, heartbreak, and discrimination. This exhibition navigates the ways in which desire, oppression, humanization, sympathy, self-hate, and emotional apathy are imposed on queer black men through the media, family, romance, and false narratives of hyper-masculinity. We have Rakim on the line with us in the studio. Hello, Rakim.
Hello, how are you?
Hello, hello. Great, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Absolutely.
Oh, no problem. My pleasure.
What is White Artist about?
So what you were saying, the show kind of explores a little bit of everything. I feel like it's kind of representative of the work that I do right now and what I want to do. And it's a series of 8 self-portraits, and it was taken from 2 photo series. And the curator, his name is Eddie Garland. He's a great, great curator, great guy. And essentially what the show was kind of about was getting these selection of images that I kind of felt this emotional connection to. So I use a lot of textures in my work, and the specific images that are in the show are kind of times where I was going through a hard time or going through a rough time. So one of the series was actually kind of about I came home and I believe I was like rejected by this guy I was in love with at the time, and like he didn't feel the same way, and I just kind of wrapped myself in this tool, which is like a fabric that's used, I believe it's used on tutus and that kind of thing for ballerinas and whatnot. And I photographed myself in it, and then I did like a little video piece to kind of like unwrap myself out of it, because it's more so like, this is a material that's, it's translucent, you can kind of see through it, but it's also kind of hard to escape out of. And then the other kind of photo series was about more so like fetishization of gay black men. And I used these trash bags to cover up my face, but like the rest of my body would be exposed or something like that. And more so like white men or different races of people of color would not necessarily want to date me or want me or interact with me for the person that I am, or more so the stereotypes of what they think my body encompasses. So that was more so the inspiration behind the photographs that were selected for the show.
You kind of covered it in that question, but what specifically changed for you as a person after you came out?
Everything. I think sometimes like when people think of coming out, it's more so like, oh, well, you know, I'm able to date guys now, but it's really kind of like a culture shift. I think when you come out, I had to learn to go to new places. So I started to go to gay bars. I hung out with, you know, new queer friends. Like there's dating apps as you navigate. Like I'm still kind of learning like what I like to wear and that kind of thing. So my whole life kind of changed, but I think it's a good change for the better. And then it also really let me know who
you know, was there for me as a person and who really cared about me and who didn't. Because there were some people that were kind of like, oh, I'm not really sure about this or whatever. And then there were some people like, yeah, like I knew or that kind of thing. But it really kind of told me who was my family. And then it really gave me the chance to choose my own found family. And I think that was the best part of it.
I'm talking about just the painfulness and the invisibility that comes up with coming out and definitely being a cutie pock, as people lovingly say. There's a lot of just history with healing from trauma, whether it's having to emotionally distance yourself from, like, say, family or people you thought were your friends. Was that a part of your experience, and has it been, you know, that very real aspect of queer culture, and has that influenced your art?
Oh, definitely. I think more so the family aspect of it, because I was actually outed to my family. I didn't tell them. I had came out in this very, like, cliche way where I had saw that, like, Frank Ocean, like, wrote this letter on, I think it was his notes app on his MacBook, and I did the same thing, and I took a screenshot and posted it, and then my cousin told my mom, and my mom was like, what are you talking about? And so since then, yeah, I've definitely have to learn to heal, and a lot of my artwork is about kind of like this self-healing and self-growth from not only just trauma about, like, coming out, but, like, there's also, you know, the double layer where the things intersect, where I'm also a Black man in America too. So a lot of my work kind of incorporates, well, not necessarily now, but before, incorporated a lot of, like, flowers and plants and that kind of thing, because I feel like they're symbols of growth. So I would, like, glue leaves to my face, or, like, entangle like vines around me or something like that, because it, in a way, it was more so a way for me to feel like this organic material that has to, or organic matter that has to, like, bend and weave and bob, like how vines grow. They grow no matter what the conditions are. That's kind of how I see myself. So it's definitely reflected in my work.
And have you always created art that focuses on identity?
Yeah, and not really by choice. When I started, when I picked up a camera for the first time, I was 16, and it was because I didn't have friends. And so on the weekends, instead of, you know, like, hanging out with your friends at the mall or, like, going to a movie, I would, like, grab a tripod, my little camera that I got for Christmas that I, like, begged my mom for when I was 16, and I got two cardboard boxes, and I would carry them to the park, and I would photograph myself, because it was a way for me to find out who I was. And when you take pictures of yourself, I feel like you're in a way learning these little things about yourself physically and emotionally, mentally and spiritually that you wouldn't necessarily do. So my work has always been about identity, and not necessarily always mine. You know, when I photograph different people, it's kind of about displaying and putting identities that I don't necessarily see on a platform, and kind of photographing them as living subjects of art as well.
Well, tying off of identity, this might be an obvious question for some people, but why don't white people create art about identity?
Because I don't think they have to. Like, and I was very careful to phrase it that white people don't have to, and that they don't, and not that they don't. Because, you know, I was very careful with that, because I think that some white artists do, but I think the reason for the title is because if I was a minimalist painter and didn't take self-portraiture and that kind of thing, like, and you knew that I was a Black artist, like, the first thing you would think, you wouldn't think I would do minimalist painting. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's kind of this connotation for Black artists to make this work about, like, generational trauma and healing and that kind of thing, which, you know, is fine, and I do it, but it's also, I wanted people to have the option to explore. I want, like, artists of color and Black people specifically to have the option to explore different kinds of art and not necessarily be kind of put and stuck in this box. So it's not saying that, like, you know, white artists don't make work about this or they can't make work about this. They absolutely can. But I feel like it's sometimes expected of Black artists. And the way I've been kind of rationalizing it in my head is, like, FKA Twigs says this thing where she
feels like she makes experimental music, but because she's black, people always categorize it as R&B music, where she doesn't feel like it is. And I think she should have the right to say, well, I don't make R&B music. I make experimental music, and because I'm black, you're putting this kind of preconceived notion on me. And so this was more so, the title is more so a conversation starter for people to really kind of look like, well, why do we put these expectations on black artists? And not only black artists, like artists of color too. And I think that we should really allow them the freedom to do whatever they want and not really define the term black artist as like, you know, as a one note thing. Like, black artists can be minimalist painters, they can be photographers, they can be like food photographers, they can do commercial work. It doesn't need to like be quantified in this one movement, where I feel like white artists don't have that problem at all.
Well, thank you, Rakim. We're wrapping up. Do you want to let our folks know really quick where they can catch your show?
Sure. So the show will be at the Lippman and White Gallery at the University of Portland from July 5th through July 28th. The reception will be tomorrow from July 14th, from 6 to 8 p.m., and I will be there as well. So if you want to chat, you're more than welcome to do that.
So, awesome. Thank you so much for taking time.
No problem. Thank you. Thank you.
The KBOO Evening News team has been reporting direct from South America this year via Nico Bedoya, and last week acquired a new South American contact in Peru. Our Thursday board operator, Matt Olson, is taking his last evening with us tonight, and he's accepted a teaching job in Peru for the next couple of years. Tonight, we tip our caps to Matt and share our thanks and some of our fondest memories.
My fondest memory of Matt in the, actually, I guess it's been 7 months now, seven beautiful months, was that day that he wore the tiny hat, and we called him the Airroom Fidel Castro, personally. Grace, and your favorite moment?
Well, I'd say they are limited to eye contacts and being pointed to and told you're on in 10 minutes.
That's right.
Or 10 seconds.
That's right. Well, Matt,
which are fond memories, they're
very,
by the way.
You know, that eye contact is really spot on.
Yeah.
And the pointing, beautiful.
Cuts me every time.
Every time. Mm-hmm. Matt, we at KBOO will miss you so much. So much. Best of luck to you in Peru. You're amazing.
Buen viaje.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure pushing all of your buttons.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and as always, we encourage your participation. Call us in the newsroom with your breaking stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman, Jamila Burden, Tim Nakayama, and Grace Ann Smith. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is myself, Celis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on the Facebook and the Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Celis Marchant.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Positively Revolting, Ani and Lynn take your calls. At 9, the beloved community addresses the spiritual foundations of nonviolence, activism, and peace building. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the Digital Divide looks at Portland women in science and Science Hack Day Portland 2017. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Good night, Zealous.
Good night, Grace Ann.
Good night, Matthew.
Good night, and good luck.
Thanks.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
KBOO reported earlier this month on Oregon State University's decision to demolish its adjacent community center, the Corvallis Multilingual Literacy Center, also known as the Sunflower House. The community center has housed a large portion of OSU's international programs. I spoke with Valerie Jores at length about the progress of the organization protesting the demolishment called Save CMLC. Well, Valerie George, thank you so much again for taking the time to talk to me and our listeners about what is taking place in Corvallis. Do you want to tell our audience about what CMLC is and what's happening between that community center and OSU?
I will. Thanks. Thanks so much for having me on. The Corvallis Multicultural Literacy Center, also known as CMLC, is a community-based nonprofit learning center which is situated right on the corner of Oregon State University land, and it's been a bridge between the university and the city for the last 12 years, and it's in a historic building, an old house that was built 107 years ago, always painted yellow, so it's always been known in this community as the Sunflower House. And currently, OSU has plans to demolish it because they are building more student housing and then adjacent parking, and so they need that space there, they believe, to build the housing and the parking. And what our community effort, which is called Save CMLC, is trying to convince the university to build around the Sunflower House and actually use it as a model for the way that they design the student housing, and so that it has a friendly interface between Corvallis and the university, which is part of the agreement between the university and the town, that that it would interface well together.
I remember there was a planning committee and had the pleasure of listening to that, where there was much speculation about the size of the parking lot and whether that would be possible to have the dorm structure built around that. What kind of advancements came out of that planning meeting thus far? I think that was early June it took place.
I'm not sure where the planning's at now. I do know that the building itself, the Sunflower House and the adjacent parking, only takes up 5% of that lot, which is going to be developed. There's also trees that are protected, and there's also some kind of wetlands issues, so it's not as if all of that land is usable, but I know they're looking at different possibilities, and I think maybe what it's going to come down to for the university is if it's more financially sound to demolish the building and build, or to build around it. So I think that's what they're assessing right now, because there's, of course, costs contained in either way you go. And we've been working, our Save CMLC group has been working with Restore Oregon, which is based out of Portland, and they have quite a bit of data about the environmental impact of demolishing a building of that age, just because of the materials. Oftentimes at that age, the really high-quality materials that were used to build it, it's still a very structurally sound, sturdy building. Everything that's contained within it, and then the demolition, the impact on the environment of any demolition, they say to recuperate all that is lost is about 50 years. So we've been working with them on this, and different environmental groups and all different kinds of community organizations, including the neighborhood association that would be greatly impacted by 300 to 400 students in a single lot at a very busy intersection in the middle of a
of town and then their cars as well.
I understand there's been a long-standing partnership between the Sunflower House and OSU. How many programs from OSU, or I should say probably students, use Sunflower House? What kind of programs does Sunflower House host?
Oh, right now, mm-hmm. as the multicultural center,
mm-hmm.
It's a pretty wide variety, because if you're just talking about undergraduate students, there's lots of internships and different ways that the students use the center, including that there's 4,000 international students right now at OSU. And for some of the students, they participate in the INTU program on campus, which is quite costly. And then a lot of the students, like particularly we've been working with the Iranian students, most of them do not come from wealthy families, and they're not supported by wealthy governments. And so they're here on their family's dollar, and so they can't really afford the very high-priced English classes and courses that are offered through the M2 program. And so they take advantage of the free English classes and conversation circles at the Multicultural Literacy Center. And it's also a way not just to have classes and improve their English, but actually to have partnerships. So like through the CMLC right now, there's over 200 active partnerships, and that's between someone who wants to learn a language and someone who is happy to help tutor someone in a language. And a lot of times it's people wanting to learn or practice their English, but sometimes it's someone from the community wanting to learn German. So they find someone, sometimes a student from OSU, who can tutor them in German. So there's all different opportunities like that, but then there's a whole other segment of the population at OSU, which is visiting professors and researchers and those people, and visiting scholars. There's over 550 of those people who have come from all over the world, and they oftentimes bring their families. And so nothing that's offered at OSU is extended in those ways to their families. So like many times a visiting scholar will bring their wife or husband and their children, and the wife begins to take English classes at the CMLC, she can bring her children with her. The classes are free. The partnership she ends up getting, the conversation circles are all free to her, but also there's free childcare. So her children can be there. She can take a class. And then what oftentimes happens is that she then will end up turning around and teaching a skill that she has, which can be, you know, anything, but oftentimes it's cooking. And so the center was really set up to be a living room of learning, and everyone who comes there is both a teacher and a student. So it's not a one-way street. It's very much a reciprocal thing, and it gives people, I would say that 75% of the people from other countries who use the center are women. And so this is oftentimes their first connection with the United States, their first connection with Oregon and with Corvallis. So this is their entryway into the community.
Hmm. How can people get involved with Saving Sunflower House?
We have we have a Facebook page, Save CMLC. We're developing a website. You can also go to the CMLC.org website or CMLC's own Facebook page. People could, I think that's the best way is through social media and through the website. I would say that right now we're working on several different fronts, but we've been collecting petition signatures, and we have an online change.org petition, which is also Save Corvallis Multicultural Literacy Center, and it sends emails to the Ed Ray, who's the president of OSU, and to the OSU Board of Trustees, because they would be the ones who would make the decision about saving the center. They have been very generous, and we always want to recognize that, because 12 years ago, when the people who started the CMLC had this vision that they wanted to create this center that was the whole world in a house, and they had an idea of what they wanted to do and how they wanted to connect the people in the community with the people coming to our community who don't speak English, whether they're immigrants or refugees, and the international students. And so they approached the university and then negotiated a deal with them. They took the building over, which was slated to be demolished 12 years ago and was all boarded up, and they did all the renovations. They have assumed the liability. They've maintained the place and made it an incredibly beautiful, interesting 14-room, very vibrant center. And in exchange, they've paid $1 a year rent for the last 12 years. So they've had this really wonderful symbiotic relationship with the university. It's not a university program. It's a community-based nonprofit, and it supports both the learning in the community and the university, but it's reliant on the university to save it. It's their decision. Can I tell you about one more thing
we've got a couple
recently?
More minutes. Yeah.
Okay. Just recently, on I believe it was June 30th, in the Oregon legislature, they passed House Bill 2845, which was sponsored by Diego Hernandez from Portland, and it's now requiring that ethnic studies be part of the required curriculum for K through 12 in schools all over Oregon. So we're thinking about what amazing timing this is for our campaign to save the Multicultural Literacy Center, because literally for 12 years they've collaborated with the Corvallis school system and with the local libraries for this entire area, and they've always hosted field trips from all the schools. Like, I was there one day when 80 fourth graders had just come through, and they had been divided up in different rooms, and in the back classroom there was a group of students learning some Mandarin Chinese, and in the music room they were getting to touch and play and see different instruments from around the world, and then in the crafts room they were learning something else, and then a little mini cooking class in the kitchen. And everyone who was leading those students through the center were people from all over the world. So they were literally being able to host and share their culture with these school children. And Corvallis is a very white community, like Portland, if it weren't for OSU. But we have 50 languages spoken in the schools. So this is really an opportunity to practice that. And then in 2013, the Multicultural Center started developing what they call cultural exploration kits, and they now have over 40 large and mini portable museums in a box. And those go out on the bookmobile to rural schools. They go to classes. About 6,000 people a year get to use these different culture kits that span cultures from all over the world and are filled with items that have been donated, artifacts and things that have been donated by volunteers and students and from all over the world. So I think that in this way, the collaboration between the CMLC and the local schools and libraries could be a model for places all over the state. So that's very exciting, too.
That is really exciting. Well, thank you again for taking the time. Yeah.
Thank you.
Have a great afternoon.
Thanks a lot.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:58. Up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale. Your unwanted books, records, and DVDs are treasures to someone else. Help them find new homes while raising money for your community radio station, KBOO. Bring them to KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. We are accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Friday, August 11th. Please, no home-recorded cassettes, VHS tapes, or mold. The KBOO book and record sale will be held on Saturday, August 19th. If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email Ani at volunteer@kboo.org or phone her at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, we'll screen the film tomorrow on Thursday, July 13th at 7 p.m. The documentary Tomorrow sets out to showcase alternative and creative ways of viewing agriculture, economics, energy, and education. It offers constructive solutions to act on a local level to make a difference on a global level. Instead of showing all the worst that can happen, this documentary focuses on the people suggesting solutions and their actions. Again, that's a film screening of the documentary Tomorrow, Thursday, July 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.